I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to Words on a Wire. Today, I am going to be talking to writer Jasmine Mendez. She just came out with a new book called Night Blooming Jasmine, Personal Essays and Poetry. And we're going to talk about her writing process. We're going to talk about her life, her poetry, her inspiration, and all those fantastic things that you want to ask writers that you admire. I just finished her book and I'm quite eager to talk to her about it. So join me and we'll talk to Jasmine. Jasmine Mendez is a Macondo Encanto Mundo Fellow, as well as a member of Voices of Our Nation's Arts, which is also known as VONA. She is the author of a multi-genre memoir called Islands of Dreams, and which was the winner of the International Latino Book Award. And this is her second book, Night Blooming Jasmine, Personal Essays and Poetry. Jasmine Mendez, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on what is your second book. You had a book come out in 2013 called Island of Dreams.
Yes, correct. Yes, this is my second book. It's with Arte Publico, and similar to my first book, it's multi-genre poetry and essays. So, but yeah, this was a much bigger undertaking than the first. So,
I've worked with Arte Publico in the past. How do you get along with them?
It's great. I mean, I think it's helpful that I live in Houston, so it's easy to kind of communicate, or if I just need to jump over to, you know, to the office or anything, I can. But it's been really great. They've been very responsive and just caring and really thoughtful about, you know, getting my book out to the right places and supporting me in whatever way I need. So I've had a really good experience so far, thankfully.
Well, you know, Jasmine, if you want, I'll make sure they never hear this. Go ahead, tell the truth. What do you really think of that?
No, it has been good. I'm very blessed.
Yeah, they've been very helpful with my last two books. They really get behind their author. So I'm really glad
to
see this book out. And I read a review of this book, and we're talking about Night Blooming Jasmine, which is personal essays and poetry, just came out this year. And one of the interviews said, Mendez illustrates through personal experience the haunting consequences of a divide between spirit and body. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, see, that reviewer, I think it's the one you're talking about, if I remember correctly, is very kind and generous. I'm very thoughtful with her review and analysis of the book. And yeah, I do. I think that I was exploring that, you know, that space, that trying to navigate, you know, who I'd wanted to become or who my plan was to be, and then how chronic illness changed that. And then, you know, trying to come to terms with that on a spiritual, emotional, sort of mental level, if you will.
And so if there's a divide between the spirit and the body, and that divide leads to haunting consequences, is the goal, for lack of a better word, to be able to unite the spirit and body in some sense?
I mean, I think so in part. I mean, I think you know, getting at that quote and thinking about it, it's this idea that the body is broken, right? And then the spirit kind of also following suit, but then trying to heal both of them. Or, you know, the spirit really having a sort of sense of energy and a sense of drive, whereas the body can't necessarily keep up with that, right? And so that's like the physical shell, right? This body that holds our spirit kind of faltering and holding us back. And I think that eventually, yes, the goal, like you said, for lack of a better word, is to try to have both of them working in tandem or in unison, or at least coming to accept that maybe the spirit needs to slow down because the body has slowed down. And so, yeah, definitely, it's a constant struggle to balance those two.
Yeah, you know, there's days when I'm more spiritual than other days, I guess you could say. And then when I, this is maybe a bad example, but when I, like, you know, eat a greasy cheeseburger and fries, suddenly my spirit just wants to be pulled down to earth with me.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's so true. There's so many things that can affect, right, our spirit, because then with things that affect our body, right, that then inadvertently sort of like affect the spirit. And so, no, I totally get that for sure. Mine is usually caused by lack of sleep.
Right. Well, it's because you do everything. You're the most active person I know, I think.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Lupe, my husband, might challenge you on that. He's pretty active.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I know Lupe. Yeah, he was a student of ours in the MFA program, definitely. Mm-hmm. So you write very honestly, in fact, about having scleroderma. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, scleroderma, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how it affected you artistically and spiritually even?
Yeah, definitely. So scleroderma is a chronic autoimmune disease that can affect various parts of the body, various major organs. And sclero meaning hard, from Latin word hard, and then derma meaning skin, so hard skin. Uh-huh. So the way I like to break it down is, like, whenever you get a cut and, you know, your body forms scar tissue, right, extra collagen to heal that scar. What happens with scleroderma is that your body basically thinks that certain major organs are like defunct or bad, and so it creates an excess amount of this scar tissue, excess amount of collagen, which can harden, make it kind of like tighten and toughen the skin, kind of like a turtle shell, and so it makes movement difficult, right? And so aside from the skin, which is like the major organ of the body that it can affect the lungs, the heart, the kidneys, and things like that, and cause difficulty breathing and heart problems and blood pressure problems and things like that. And so for me, it affected various areas. It didn't go to my internal organs. My lupus diagnosis did, and that's another autoimmune disease, because sometimes these diseases can cluster, and you can have sort of symptoms of a couple of them. But with scleroderma, it affected, you know, my skin and tightened, so it inhibited my mobility for the first few years that I was first diagnosed before kind of I was put on like really aggressive treatment for it. And then it really affected my hands, which as a writer, that's like the worst thing, right, that it could affect. You know, there are some days I'm like, look, I'd rather, you know, not be able to walk than like lose the ability to use my hands because I'm a writer. Right. What am I going to do if I can't use my hands? And, you know, it sort of crippled the joints in my hands for a little while. It caused these really painful like ulcers on the tips of my fingers, which could get infected. And I had several surgeries on my right hand. I'm right hand dominant. So I had to become sort of half, almost ambidextrous. I can't write with my left hand, but I can pretty much do everything else with my left hand because I had to teach myself how to do that. And so, yeah, it made writing a lot slower. It's made living a lot slower. I'm in a much better place now physically with all of my illnesses. But for a good 8 or 9 years, I just had to relearn how to do a lot of things and be patient with myself and show myself more compassion with the writing process, with the living process. You know, some days I can like, I could get up and like do 20 million things. And then the next day was like, okay, I'm in bed for like 3 days straight recovering from that one day and sort of just learning to go with the ebb and flow of my body and what it was asking me to do and how it was teaching me to care for it. You know, basically I had to learn how to take better care of myself.
There's this concept that I'm thinking of as you were talking, and it's a mystic concept that, you know, everything, even those things that are seemingly negative, we have the ability to receive them as a gift. Was it a struggle for you to receive this as a gift? I mean, ultimately, obviously, if this book came out of it, it's a gift to us. But was it difficult for you to see it as a gift and to slow down and or allow yourself to slow down and make something of your situation?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's another one of those things, kind of like the grieving process, right? Like the acceptance isn't like a point you get to. It's a constant thing. Like you're constantly ebbing and flowing through these different stages of grief. Same thing, you know, I think with this illness and accepting it as a gift or as whatever, you know, whatever you want to describe it as, there are moments and even years or months where I'm like, you know, I'm lucky to live this life. This illness has given me so much more perspective on how to take things slow, what I really want to do, about not wasting time, about only doing those things that bring me joy and fill me with love and passion. But there are other days, you know, where I'm just like, stupid disease, and I want to like kick things, you know? And that's just like, because it complicates and makes things harder, right? And so you have to kind of, I try to feel my feelings. I don't try to suppress things anymore. I just try to feel them, and then I just kind of move forward. I do think that having the illness, aside from, you know, giving me this story to write, right? It's connected me to a community of other individuals with chronic illness. It's connected me with just other humans and other people, because the more I get out there and share my stories, the more people come to me and sort of confide in me that they have illness and that, you know, that they're scared to talk about it out loud, or that it's so taboo to talk about illness. And so I think that it's brought me closer to people that maybe I never thought I even had anything, you know, in relation to.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a gift to others. I could see that, because I mean, you know, read this and you're turning it into something beautiful. But I'm also wondering, like, I can't help but think of the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, and I'm wondering how many of these you experience once you knew what you had: the denial, anger, bargaining, depression. And I love what you said, that acceptance is a process. It's not just one thing, you accept it, but that you continue have to do it. What about these others, the denial, the anger, the bargaining?
Yeah, I experienced all of them many times over. It's like a giant roller coaster, up and down, and round, you kind of go. You know, and it's interesting, because I felt like with not only with each illness that you get diagnosed with, do you have to go through the grieving process and like realize, okay, what does this mean? What am I losing because of this? And accepting it and denying it and getting angry about it and trying to bargain. But you also, I think, go through that when you have these kind of illnesses with side effects of medications that you have to suddenly deal with loss of mobility for certain things, with loss of the ability to maybe work full time. You have to grieve that process. You have to grieve, you know, for me for a while, it was, you know, I couldn't have children when I wanted to have children, you know, and so I had to grieve that loss. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, there's so many losses that happen when you get diagnosed with a chronic illness that can limit your mobility or that affects your body so drastically. And you're constantly going through different stages of the grieving process. And maybe several of them at the same time, right? Like you may suddenly be really depressed because, you know, you have chronic fatigue, and then you're really angry though about the fact that like I couldn't use my hands. Like I'm angry and I'm depressed. Like all of these emotions are happening at the same time for different things. And so it's kind of a miracle that I didn't like sort of end up going totally insane. But yeah, you kind of go through the grieving process many different times, many different ways. And again, it's not like a linear thing. I always try to tell people, like, grief is not linear.
Right, that's
you know,
a really
important concept. And you go back and forth through these different emotions. Sometimes in one day, right? Like, there would be days I'd wake up really sad, and then by the middle of the day, I'd, like, really, really angry, and then I'd start praying and be like, God, just take it away, and I'll do this. And, you know, by the end of the day, you're just like, okay, fine. Like, you know, it is what it is. And you cross that obstacle and keep it moving. So it's definitely a lot of emotions. And I think I'm kind of on the other side of most of things, because like I said, I'm a much better place sort of health-wise, so it's kind of easier to feel okay. But there are moments, you know, where some of the other emotions creep in. You know, if I can't do something at the speed that I want to, or, you know, if I just happen to wake up and have like a really bad fatigue day, then, you know, kind of get back to being like, ah, this is my whole life, right? You know, you're kind of always dealing with the fact like, this is what I'm going to have for the rest of my life.
Wow.
And, you know, when you're diagnosed at 22, the rest of your life is a potentially long time.
Wow.
So it can be, you feel daunting for sure.
That's interesting that you can experience fragments of emotions throughout the day going back and forth. And I'm wondering, you know, as I read this book, which is really a beautiful book, you know, about many things, including dealing with this illness, Night Blooming Jasmine, it's personal essays and poetry, which is in itself pretty rare. I mean, you know, we're a book of essays and poetry in the same one. And I'm wondering if those fragmented energies that you experienced because of your illness, if it affected you in terms of your writing and perhaps going from one genre to a next, depending on how you feel.
Right, definitely. Yes, that's exactly it. I mean, for me, for a while, you know, the only emotions that would, you know, and writing that would come would be in the form of poetry and poems, and I was just sort of spilling out all these poems. And then, and that was early on in sort of the writing of this book. Well, when I was first diagnosed, I knew I wanted to write a memoir about this experience, but then I was kind of like, well, I'm not really sure what that looks like. And, you know, I was really only kind of writing poems because I hadn't really delved too much into prose or essays yet at the time. And then as the disease just kept getting complicated and more complicated, and I kept having, you know, more lows and more hospital stays and more complications with things, I just started sort of pumping out these essays. And I was like, well, what is this? What's going on? You know? And I kind of fell in love with the essay form. And it just seemed like the right form for a lot of what I was experiencing. I was like, I have too much to say. I can't condense it to poetry. Like, I have way too much to say, you know. And occasionally a poem would kind of creep in there and I'd write it, you know, and kind of just leave it off to the side. And then, yeah, the more I thought about it, I was like, this disease is complex. My identity as a woman of color with an illness is complex. I really feel like this sort of what Jen Soriano calls a intersectional form to represent my intersectional like identities, right? My intersectionalities. And it just felt right. And I also think that with the poetry, that kind of allows the reader a little bit of like breathing room from like one sort of, you know, harrowing scene to the next, right? It's not just sort of all these essays of just like all these terrible things that occurred to me over 10 years. But you have like some poetry to kind of sprinkled in there, you know, to get you out of that for a little bit.
So. Right. And what is the difference in your writing process when you're writing essays and when you're writing poetry? And is that difference sometimes influenced by how you feel?
Yes, no, definitely, definitely. I definitely think while they both tend to come from a place of urgency, like an urgent emotion or event that has occurred, you know, my poetry, as for like for many people, I think is a lot slower at times. I really marinate in my head more than anything about a poem before I ever put anything down on the page. And, you know, I'll think about the lines and the stanzas and the form, if it's going to have a specific poetic form. And, you know, I read a lot of things to kind of help, you know, get me thinking of kind of what direction I want to take the poem in. And then maybe after about like a week or two, or sometimes a couple months of just, you know, every other day just marinating on this poem, then I'll sit down and write. And then I usually think it's terrible the first time around. I have to put it away and come back to it again later. And so it's a much longer process. Whereas with essays, usually there's like an event or a scene or a very strong image that brings me to the page. And I'm okay with just kind of what I call word vomiting on the page and just putting it all out there in like the first draft.
Right.
And then really for me, the writing happens in revision with both poetry and essay. But I really can have a lot of fun with revision when it comes to essays. I avoid it like the plague because I'm just like, oh, I don't want to get back to that because I don't want to see how bad it is. but when I finally, you know, get in there and I make myself sit down and revise an essay, I mean, like that's where for me, like the magic and the joy of writing really happens.
Wow. You know, you are a unique writer because, you know, when you describe your process with poetry and you describe your process through essays, I would think that for most writers, it would be the reverse, that the poetry is what comes out and the essays is what you think about and almost mentally outline first. But, you know, you do it the opposite way. And that's really interesting, and which is another thing that makes you such a unique writer.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think some of that, too, comes from I've journaled for years. And so I kind of approached my essay writing with the lens of a little bit of journaling, right? This is first just like a journal entry. This is just my thoughts, my ideas, kind of a rant sometimes. And then once I can go back in with a new eye after a few days, I can say, oh, this is the focus of this essay, or this is, you know, the one paragraph that I really want to develop and dig into. And the rest of it's just kind of gibberish. But, you know, and so that's kind of how I approach it. Sometimes I will kind of do the same process with an essay that I've done with a poem. If I'm looking for something that's like a braided essay or something lyrical, something that's less sort of scene or event-based. But yeah, I usually am just like word vomit, and then revision is where like the real writing happens.
Kitsune, yeah. I'm talking to Jasmine Mendez, whose book Night Blooming Jasmine, Personal Essays and Poetry, it just came out. And Jasmine, we're both part of the same literary community, so we know a lot of the same people. I know your partner very well, and we know a lot of people. You know, you're in Houston, and but the first time I think I met you in person was in Ciudad Juarez a couple of years ago. There was a poetry encuentro de poesía or Feria de Libros. I forget what the event was, but they brought poets and fiction writers from all over the place, and they flew you down from Houston and had you participate in that. Mm-hmm. And I was also there, and when your reading start, my wife, she was sitting next to me, and she grabbed my hand, and she squeezed it, and she says, I love this poet. You just had so much energy, and you sang it out, and you know, and I'm thinking, my gosh, where does this woman get her energy? And so I imagine that that when you do have these moments when you're performing, you just put everything into it. And wasn't theater your first love?
Yes, it was. And it still is. It's sort of one of those, you know, it's like your first boyfriend or girlfriend. Right? You kind of like, oh, you have that nostalgia for that first love. Yeah, theater and performance was where I sort of started with my artistic endeavors back in, you know, middle school. I just fell in love with being on stage and, you know, getting to play different characters. And looking back on it now, I really also realized that I actually did love the language of theater, of a lot of the plays that, that I read and was a part of. I loved being able to, like, bring that language to life, right? It was like putting a book that you love and seeing it, you know, live. And so I loved that part of it. Always been an avid reader, but I never thought I could be a writer until much, much later, because I was like, well, I'm not an old dead white guy, so you know, I can't, no one's going to publish me, you know, that with the exception of a few like Maya Angelou and Langston Hughes, hadn't been exposed to any other writers that looked like me or sounded like me. So I really put all my efforts into theater all through middle, high school, college, a little bit after college. And really, I will say that is, I guess, in a one way how I see my illness as a gift, is that because of my illness, I just physically could not act anymore.
Right.
You know, acting is very draining. And so I said, well, I need something. And so I started really taking my writing a lot more seriously, because I was like, I need an outlet. I need to express myself. I've written these sort of bad poems in the past, but let me like see what I can really do if I start to try to hone my craft. And so, I feel like to bring the performance aspect to my readings, you know, keep it engaging. And I did do performance poetry for many, many years. So I do like that. And yes, it is exhausting, but definitely worth it.
Well, you know, I find that really beautiful what you're saying about, you know, one of the things that attract you to theaters and to plays were the language. You wanted to say it. You wanted to speak those words. And I'm wondering, is there a particular playwright or a particular play or even a particular passage or a particular line that you read and thought, I have to say this. I have to perform this.
So, yes, I would say it's until Saki Sheng's For Colored Girls is Considered Suicide When the Rainbow is Enough.
Oh, beautiful.
And it's literally, and I have performed it a couple of times, but I love it. It's the last line of, I found God in myself and I loved her. I loved her fiercely.
Oh, beautiful.
And yeah, I mean, it gives me chills every time. And I think that play in particular, because it is poetry, right? It's persona poems and choreo poems strung together to tell these stories. And I think it's so beautiful and so well done. But, you know, I also did plays. When I did my first Spanish play by Federico García Lorca, I did Yerma. Just that also, I was like, wow, Spanish plays. Like, I was so, it's beautiful. You know, Spanish is just such a beautiful language. And when it's done well, I just fell in love, you know, with theater all over again in that show also.
Yeah, you describe yourself somewhere as an Asian, Afro-Latino, Dominican raised in the Deep South.
Yes.
It's like, what a wonderful tradition. You may be the only one I've ever heard described that way. Where in the Deep South did you grow up, and how did that influence you artistically?
For sure. You know, it's something that I haven't really thought about until the last few years when I kind of really analyzed where I grew up. I'm a military brat, and so I was born in Alabama. Lupe used to say that he used to call me a Bama girl, and I was like, please understand, I lived in Alabama literally for like 6 seconds. I was born there, and then like about a year or two later, my dad was stationed elsewhere. And so we lived in various states in the South, but Alabama, Louisiana, Tennessee, and finally Texas. And we did spend like 2 years in Germany, but then quickly came back to the States, and my dad was stationed here in Texas. And so I never really kind of processed that experience, I don't think, because for me, I was just a kid, right? I'm just sort of like living in all these different places. And the only thing that was stable was like my family home situation, right? My mom, my dad, my brother, my sister. Everything else is just kind of like on the periphery, like, oh, this is fine for now, but we know we're going to have to move in a couple years. And so, but as you know, as I get older, I definitely, when I kind of hang out with other Dominican Americans who are mostly from New York, I'm just like, oh, I'm so different from you all. And not in a good or bad way or in any kind of way, just different, you know? And so I didn't necessarily grow up with the same community of Dominicans around me.
Right.
And so I think that I always felt very kind of outsider, right? I wasn't really accepted by the Black kids. I definitely wasn't accepted by the white kids. When I came to Texas, the Mexicans were like, we don't know what to do with you. And so it was a very...
Yeah, and how did you learn Spanish? I'm sure they've said to you before.
Yes, oh, always. I mean, that was always the question. Like, how do you speak Spanish? You're Black. We don't understand. It was like, you know, I call myself a purple unicorn in Texas.
Because that's great.
You know, nobody gets it. So yeah, I felt that sort of isolation at times growing up. And even just as an adult, you know, I still definitely feel that. I'm much more secure now and with my identity and all of those things. So I don't harp on it perhaps as much, but it doesn't affect me like emotionally in the ways that it definitely used to in my teens and 20s. But yeah, I think that being from the South, I think it's the first time I said that out loud, you know, you feel kind of polarized, right? You have to kind of choose, am I Black or am I white? And in Texas, kind of like, am I Black, brown, or white?
Mm-hmm.
And I've sort of naturally, in many instances, fallen into, you know, being Black, because I'm Afro-Latina, and so I present as like African-American, but still not always feeling at home in those spaces, right? My culture for me and my language for me is my Latina identity, my Spanish, my Dominican heritage. And so I don't necessarily always identify with African-American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been interesting. And I think that definitely makes its way into my writing, you know, and I think I'm constantly kind of thinking about that and struggling with that and trying to be okay in this sort of weird gray space that I live in.
Right. We're unfortunately running out of time. I have so many other questions for you, but so before I get to any other questions, can I ask you to read a poem from your new book, Night Blooming Jasmine? Whatever poem you like.
Yeah, I have a piece here kind of midway through the book titled Gluttony Undigested. And just briefly, one of the major issues that I dealt with a lot was heartburn and acid reflux, which sounds benign, but it can get really bad.
Oh, no, no. And did you experience this? You know, you were talking, there's this whole section in this book about wanting to get pregnant, and it ends well, I know, because you just had a baby, what, about a year ago or something? Did that heartburn increase when you were pregnant?
You know what? The complete opposite. I had zero heartburn
when
I was pregnant. Cause pregnancy was like the best thing that could have happened to me. Like all of my symptoms disappeared, which they say can happen sometimes.
Wow. Because my wife's pregnant and she gets extreme heartburn. So I was wondering.
Yeah, I know. I was expecting it, but I actually know I did really well.
Oh, nice. Okay, so go ahead and read this poem called Gluttony Undigested.
I am never enough. The doctors swallow my face, their eyes like tar seeping through the cracks of city pavements. Skyscraper hospitals spoon my reflection into glass and pour me into the mouth of a waiting room. A surgeon orders a CAT scan to slice my heart, arms, legs into bite-sized bits and pieces. Medical machines gnaw at my breasts and my back, salivating on scars of skin. I stick two fingers down my throat. What is there left to give? A shadow lodged in the sternum, a reflux of regret, a hole in the trachea. I gag because it hurts, because I'm hollowed, because survival is not enough.
That was Jasmine Mendez reading a poem called Gluttony Undigested. I love that line, pour me into the mouth of the waiting room. That's beautiful. And the book is beautiful. It's called Night Blooming Jasmine, Personal Essays and Poetry. And check out her webpage, jasminemendez.com. That's Jasmine with two N's and an E, Mendez.com. Jasmine, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
I'd like to thank Jasmine Mendez for joining us on Words on a Wire. The name of the book is Night Blooming Jasmine, Personal Essays and Poetry. And it's a brand new book put out by Arte Publica Press. I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank our producer, Stefania Castro, and I'd like to thank you, dear reader, but you're not a reader. Well, I guess you are a reader. I think all the people who listen to the show because they're readers. So I'm going to go ahead and say it. I'd like to thank you, dear reader, for joining us on another Words on a Wire. See you next week.